Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we begin a four-part series on the American Civil War, exploring some of the most important and intriguing aspects of that tragic event. We begin with Louis Lemesurier, who looks at 1831, a year he believes served as a turning point in the nation's plunge into sectional violence. We'll also be hearing from George Fletcher on how Lincoln redefined American democracy during the war. But before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On March 5, 1946, Winston Churchill delivered the most important speech of his post-World War II career. It was built on the phrase, the Iron Curtain. It attracted international attention and had an enormous impact on American and Western European perceptions of the post-war political climate. The former British Prime Minister, who led a beleaguered nation through a world war, spoke at the request of President Harry Truman to a crowd of 40,000 at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. Although the title of his address, Sinews of Peace, suggested an optimistic view of post-war developments, Churchill instilled a sense of foreboding into all who listened when he reminded his audience that although the glow of victory over fascist tyranny was still strong in the hearts of British and Americans, a new tyranny was on the horizon, an ominous shadow cast by the Soviet Union. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, Churchill announced, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Churchill's speech signaled the beginning of the Cold War. 40 years later, when the war ended, a small section of the Berlin Wall was erected at the site where Churchill delivered his address as a testament to Churchill's faith that sinews of peace were mightier than iron curtains. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, etched stones uncovered by archaeologists from the floor of a South African seaside cave suggest that human beings developed modern, sophisticated behaviors well over 30,000 years earlier than previously estimated, upsetting the widely accepted theory that modern human behaviors originated around 40,000 years ago. The 77,000-year-old bits of African stone, development of art, tools, and the technology to catch food reveal that modern human behavior developed in Africa earlier than in Europe, and that the ancient South African people possessed the ability to reason, create, organize, and plan. Images of an American epic tainted by tragedy, photo negatives of the Kennedy administration, are believed to have been lost in the wake of another tragedy, that of September 11th. An estimated 40,000 negatives of President Kennedy, taken by his personal photographer Jacques Lowe, are believed to have succumbed to the weight of debris and the ravaging fires that swept the vault at the J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, part of a 9-story building adjacent to the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. This is Talking History. When you consider the years that seem momentous in American history, 1492 and 1776, and perhaps a few others come immediately to mind. 1831 probably does not. But as our guest this week, Louis Mesurier, suggests in his conversation with Talking History's Fred Nielsen, perhaps it should.
1831 was a tumultuous year in America. Radical abolitionists in the North called for immediate emancipation of slaves. A bloody slave rebellion shook the South. South Carolina threatened to leave the Union. Many feared civil war and wondered if the United States could survive as a nation. With me today to discuss these developments is Louis Mesurier, a professor of history at the City College of New York and the author of 1831, Year of Eclipse. Professor Mesurier, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to talk with you.
As the year begins, January 1, 1831, a northern abolitionist, William Lloyd Garrison, publishes the first issue of The Liberator, his anti-slavery paper. Garrison had once advocated gradual emancipation of the slaves, but now, as the year 1831 begins, he forswears moderation and calls for immediate emancipation. What accounts for that shift?
Well, it seems that Garrison had something of a conversion experience. He had experienced slavery firsthand down in Baltimore. A couple years earlier, he had been arrested for libel, and witnessing slavery and the slave trade and, of course, the slave state of Maryland, he became sensitized to the issue that he never, in a way that he never had been before. He leaves Baltimore, he travels north, and he introduces this doctrine of immediatism, immediate emancipation. You know, the idea being that if slavery is a sin, it must be renounced, not gradually, not eventually, but immediately. And as you point out, Garrison repudiates his earlier commitment to the idea of colonization, that slaves should be gradually emancipated and forced to migrate out of the country to Liberia, and he becomes the sort of leading radical abolitionist of his day.
He makes that shift in a rather loud, uncompromising fashion. What effect abroad, in the larger area of the United States, does Garrison's conversion to immediatism have?
Well, I think it has a huge effect. Even though his newspaper, The Liberator, is relatively low in terms of circulation, it's carried throughout the nation. It's carried south, often by sailors and others. And when other events emerge that year, Southerners will point to The Liberator as a paper that's devoted to trying to incite rebellion. So he's really seen as an agent provocateur by those who want to sort of preserve the institution and who want to maintain the sort of stability of the state. You know, his life is threatened. He's often attacked, and but he never relents. You know, his rhetoric that slavery is wrong, that it's an evil, and that it must be abolished immediately, he will continue to pursue for of course over 30 years.
You alluded to the possibility of later rebellions, and of course in August of 1831 there is one of the largest slave rebellions in American history, led by a slave named Nat Turner. What do we know about Nat Turner?
Well, what we know is that he was in his mid-30s. He was of average height. He was a literate slave who could read and write, and he fancied himself something of a self-anointed preacher. He would often talk to other slaves and free persons of color and discuss the issues of redemption and salvation, and of course religious sensibilities are at a peak in America at this period. And eventually he witnesses indeed the eclipse, the solar eclipse, that is the subtitle of the book that occurred in February of 31, and he takes it as a sign from God that the time to rise up against his enslavement had occurred.
The rebellion is, at least compared to many other uprisings, a fairly bloody thing, though it doesn't succeed. How did whites react to Nat Turner's rebellion?
Well, they reacted with absolute horror. In fact, connecting it back to Garrison, they blame Garrison and Northerners who are becoming opposed to slavery as the reasons for the rebellion, because in their mind they can't possibly imagine that a slave could on his own plan such a conspiracy in this way. It absolutely outrages the South, and their reaction is in some ways to really fundamentally change the way they look at the institution. You know, we know all too well the ways in which events can subtly transform how we look at the world. And if before Nat Turner, Southerners could live with the fiction that slavery was a benign institution and that the slaves were contented, after Nat Turner's rebellion, it becomes increasingly impossible for them to hold on to that idea. There's an editorial in the Richmond Inquirer shortly after the rebellion that says, following Nat Turner, Virginians can never again feel safe, can never again feel happy.
And they were, in fact, in terms of numbers, vastly in the minority. The slaves far outnumbered the slave owners in Virginia and elsewhere.
That is absolutely correct. And so the fear of a massive servile insurrection really hits at the heart of Virginia society. And indeed, it leads directly at the end of that year to a remarkable moment in American history when the Virginia legislature actually debates at the end of 1831 and into 1832 whether or not to pass a gradual emancipation act abolishing slavery in the state of Virginia.
What were the sides in that debate? Were there people actually seriously in Virginia in 1831 advocating the end of slavery for all time?
Well, we have to be careful about that. Clearly, they're not advocating the end of it in the way that Garrison is advocating the end of it. This is a plan of gradual, compensated emancipation that, if it was achieved, would not emancipate any of the slaves until, chillingly enough, 1863 would be the date, and carried with it notions of colonization that the blacks who were freed would also be removed from the state of Virginia.
Well, that theme of removal seems to run through many of the events of 1831. There's the hope of removing freed slaves, but also in 1831 the country is in the process of removing Indians as well from the eastern part of the United States to the western parts.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And It begins in 1831 with the court cases and the challenges, particularly to what Georgia is doing with respect to kicking the Cherokee off of their lands. And, Jackson, the Democratic president, who has this complicated commitment to nationalism on the one hand and yet certain advocate of states' rights on the other, certainly is going to stand by Georgia in terms of promoting their attempt to acquire the lands of the Cherokee.
States' rights almost tears the country apart in 1831, too. The United States faced the most serious threat to the survival of the Union during that period, a threat prompted by South Carolina's opposition to a tariff bill. What was that dispute all about?
Yeah, well, it's really kind of the dispute along with slavery, right? Slavery and states' rights, any historian would say, are the two immediate causes of what will come with the Civil War. The argument over nullification is essentially that South Carolinians believe and articulate a doctrine that says the theory of the Constitution is the state compact theory, and that states can nullify an act of the federal government that they believe to be unconstitutional. A question is the tariff, a tax on imports, which Southerners felt particularly hurt them because they are largely upon imports for their survival. They also are opposed to the idea of the federal national government having that much power, and the issue of the tariff becomes linked to the issue of slavery when Southerners begin to say, wait a minute, if the government has the power to impose tariffs, what else do they have the power to do? Perhaps in the context of abolitionism in that term, they also have the power to abolish slavery. So it really marks the emergence on the national scene of the issue of states' rights in a way that will certainly challenge the Republic for decades to come.
It's partly a constitutional issue. We have the strange side of the Vice President of the United States, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, making constitutional arguments in favor of nullification, the right of a state to, in effect, veto a national law. But it goes beyond that, too. That South Carolina raises an army of sorts, and President Jackson responds.
Yeah, that's right. On this issue, Jackson is a clear nationalist. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution gives the Congress the right to levy taxes, imposts, and duties, and he thought there was no ambiguity at all about that. Of course, he and Calhoun had a tempestuous relationship to begin with, and Jackson was thrilled that when Calhoun came out in public in favor of nullification, he thought that had essentially destroyed Calhoun's career, and in many ways it did. Jackson threatens to march to South Carolina with an army if South Carolina doesn't back down from its ordinance of nullification. Quietly on the side, a political deal gets made in 1832 that will lower the duties on tariffs so as to try and appease the commercial interests in South Carolina. But again, you see the way in which the sectional question is being raised, where the dialogue is becoming bellicose and where there's real threats of secession and war in the air.
And, of course, in December of 1860, South Carolina becomes the first state to actually secede.
That's exactly right.
As you describe the country in 1831, it seems to have been shaped by both centripetal and centrifugal forces. On the one side, there are things that seem to tear people apart, restlessness as they move from one place to another, material self-interest, states' rights that we've talked about. On the other side, there are things that seem to pull them together, economic and political nationalism, even a form of patriotism. You note that the song America, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, was first sung on July 4th, 1831. How did those two forces, one pulling people together and the other seeming to pull them apart, play out in 1831?
Well, you know, it's a great observation that you make. And in some ways, those tensions have been embedded in American society and culture for a long time. And they're still very much present in our society. It's interesting because Alexis de Tocqueville visits in 1831. And it's he who really puts his finger on precisely what you're talking about. You know, he coins the phrase individualism by which to describe these Americans scurrying off, pursuing self-interest, interested only in trade and wealth. And indeed, he wonders how the Union can ever hold together. The assumption for Tocqueville is that really things are going to fly apart. There's no way the nation could hold together. The other side of that is he sees the remarkable number of voluntary associations, the reform societies, the attempt to work together to change and transform things. And he sees that perhaps as the antidote to individualism, the glue that will help keep the nation from flying off in different directions.
The subtitle of your book is The Year of Eclipse. You've already mentioned that there was a real astronomical event in February that Nat Turner and others saw. And yet, as it runs through your book, it becomes a kind of metaphor. A sense of foreboding is created as people fear other non-astronomical eclipses, civil war, dissolution of the Union being prime among them. How widespread were those fears among not only foreigners like Tocqueville, but Americans themselves?
Well, it becomes increasingly widespread. There are quotes from figures such as John Quincy Adams, who, when he sees the tariff issue erupting, writes in his diary that he imagines that this will lead directly to civil war. And that's a quote. It's Thomas Jefferson Randolph, Thomas Jefferson's grandson, who proposes gradual abolition in Virginia. And he predicts, in the end of a very stirring speech in support of his motion, that if it's not passed, he imagines a time when troops armed with black soldiers will invade Virginia's soil and wreak havoc on the society. So there's lots of foreboding and lots of commentary about the ways in which slavery and states' rights, if not somehow contained and controlled, will one day lead to civil war.
If there's that widespread sense, I wonder how it plays out in practice. Does it make people with their fears more amenable to compromise, or do they along the way harden their positions despite their fears?
Well, certainly, as we know, there's repeated attempts to compromise over the years. But I think what you also see is a sort of hardening of positions, and you begin to see the sign of cross-conspiratorial thinking, where the Union just becomes divided sectionally, and most Northerners and most Southerners are no longer speaking the same vocabulary to one another.
Well, Tocqueville is one of the ones who observes, as you point out, that in addition to the political differences, there's an increasing economic difference between the two sections. He goes to Kentucky, he goes to Ohio, they're separated by a river, and yet the river doesn't account for the vast differences in the way people go about their daily lives and business.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And in that way, you know, 1831 can also serve as really a symbol, and I use it as a device to chart the transformation of American society. You know, the movement of America from the sort of agrarian republic following the revolution to a dynamic, expansive democracy that we, of course, now know is headed toward civil war. And those differences between the sections, the sort of commercial, more industrial, more literate, and Tocqueville makes a big point about sort of literacy and newspapers and reading North versus the much more sort of agrarian traditions of the South, become enunciated in all kinds of ways. And there are technological developments at that moment that are going on in the society that are going to accelerate that transformation, such as, you know, the emergence of the railroad.
In the history of this country, certain years stand out. We learn many of them as grade school children, I suppose. 1492, 1776, 1929. You've chosen 1831, and I wonder if you could elaborate on why you think that year has particular significance as we look both backward and forward from it.
Well, you know, as we've been talking, I think the events that we mentioned, not to mention other events that take place that year, really allow us to see 1831, and people at the time saw it as the sort of staging ground on which the dominant political and social and cultural issues of the day emerge to the fore. I mean, slavery and states' rights become nationally debated questions in 1831 in ways that they hadn't been prior to then. So it is, you know, literally a significant year because it really marks the moment when the issues that would erupt 30 years later make their appearance on the scene. As I said, it also can be used as a device, and we sort of notice there are certain years that we live through, you know, this year and thinking back to 1989 and thinking back to 1968, where so many things seem to have happened, some of them connected, some not connected, that everyone had a sense that the world that would follow would be a fundamentally different place than the world that preceded it. 1831 was one of those years.
Well, Professor Major, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I've been speaking with Louis Major, author of 1831, Year of Eclipse.
We live by one constitution, that written in 1787 in the city of Philadelphia. At least that's the assumption of most of us. George Fletcher begs to differ. In this week's commentary, he argues that the Civil War, and Abraham Lincoln in particular, created a new constitutional order. Fletcher is the Cardoza Professor of Jurisprudence at Columbia University School of Law.
Americans assume that we have a single constitution that dates back to a meeting of patriots in Philadelphia in 1787. The purpose of my book, Our Secret Constitution, is to challenge this conventional assumption. Of course, in some sense, the original Constitution is still in force. But it is also true that the original Constitution died in the Civil War, and in its ashes there was born a radically different postbellum constitutional order. The beginning of the new constitutional order lies in the Gettysburg Address, November 19, 1863. Lincoln ignores the first constitution and returns 67 years in the past to 1776 and the Declaration of Independence. The first constitution emphasized the ideas of voluntary association, freedom, and republican elitism as a mode of government. The new postbellum constitution, inspired by Lincoln, stressed three opposing values. First, organic nationhood in place of a voluntary coming together of we the people. Second, equality alongside of freedom as a basic value. And third, popular democracy instead of rule by an elite of land-owning white men. The value of nationhood explains why the South could not secede. America must survive and flourish, Lincoln believed, as a single nation. The commitment to the equality of all was critical as the antidote to the corruption of a constitution that accommodated slavery and a Supreme Court that promoted it. Popular democracy expressed the principle of equality by securing a voice in government for all citizens. All of these ideas are expressed in the first sentence of the Gettysburg Address. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Lincoln made it clear in this single sentence that he was bent on establishing a new constitutional order that would depart radically from the assumptions of 1787. To some extent, Lincoln's vision was realized in the constitutional amendments adopted after the Civil War, but the victory was short-lived. The Supreme Court intervened in the 1870s and 1880s to defeat Lincoln's vision of a new order based upon nationhood, equality, and democracy. The Supreme Court could not eradicate Lincoln's vision. It could only bury it temporarily. The principles of nationhood, equality, and democracy became our secret constitution, still living in the shadows of the Supreme Court's power, ready to emerge when the political circumstances became more favorable. In our own time, we have seen a progressive emergence of Lincoln's view of a new constitutional order. The Supreme Court might continue to disappoint many, but the principles born on the killing fields of the Civil War shape and determine our political behavior. In our secret constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy, the details emerge. I document how Lincoln's principles of nationhood, equality, and democracy are rapidly coming to the center of our political life.
You've been listening to George Fletcher, author of Our Secret Constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy. This is Talking History. No figure is more central to the history of the American Civil War and the emancipation of slaves than Frederick Douglass. But there's much more to the story, as you'll learn if you visit his house in Washington. Here to tell you about it, as our site of the week, is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Frederick Douglass was one of the most eloquent voices of the abolition movement. The fact that he was a former slave gave his voice an authority few could match. When he moved to Washington, D.C. permanently in 1877, Douglass bought the home known as Cedar Hill, which had a view of the city and the Capitol Dome. The house is now a National Historic Site and tells the life of Douglass room by room, from the portraits of fellow abolitionists William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips that hang in the parlor to Abraham Lincoln's walking stick, given to Douglass by Mary Lincoln after the president's assassination in 1865. Douglass had welcomed the Civil War and persuaded Lincoln to enlist black soldiers in the Union cause. He was named a minister to Haiti in 1899, the first black man ever appointed to an ambassadorial rank. As a writer, newspaper editor, lecturer, and spokesman for black America, Douglass was as well known to the 19th century as Martin Luther King Jr. became in his century.
And finally, turning to our recommendations of coming attractions, it's an oft-told but still fascinating tale of how various immigrant groups came to America and adapted their ways to their strange new world. While retaining the essentials of their unique cultural heritage, it is the story of America and a nation of immigrants, also the story of one group in particular, American Jews. That story, as experienced by Jewish women, is the focus of a new exhibit, Unpacking on the Prairie, Jewish Women in the Midwest, currently in the gallery of the Jewish Community Center in Omaha, Nebraska. Told through diaries, photos, and other personal possessions, the exhibit brings to light the strength and ingenuity of Jewish women pioneers on the remote Great Plains. Unpacking on the Prairie will be in Omaha until April 21st. For information on its future venues, contact the Minnesota Historical Society, which, along with the Jewish Historical Society of the Midwest, originated the exhibit. On March 16th, tune in the History Channel for a program on the making of the classic movie, The Diary of Anne Frank. Director George Stevens faced the daunting challenge of doing justice to this tragic Holocaust story while making it appealing to as wide an audience as possible. Find out how he did it in Diary of Anne Frank on March 16th, but be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtime. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week for the second part in our series on the American Civil War. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.